You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Elliot Richardson's going to drop by later on in this hour. Paul Guppy is going to be on in our second hour, the Vice President of Research for the Washington Policy Center. Cars and bicycles, government affairs. We got all kinds of stuff going on today. It's going to be a really interesting day. It's also, of course, the day after the day that the war in Iraq started. From an Iraqi point of view, today is the day, the 20th, is the day that the war started. It started the morning of the 20th in Iraq, the evening of the 19th in the United States. Interesting, I was watching the coverage, ABC coverage over the Daily Kos. There's a 10-minute clip of that first, discussion. And out of the entire 10 minutes, there was less than a fragment of a sentence where just for a second they flashed a bunch of protesters in front of the White House, and that was it. The only words about that. So we're going to get back to that as well, although we talked about that at some length yesterday. And, you know, what's going on in Congress? And the Senate, of course, filibustering another Obama appointee. Meanwhile, the assault weapons ban has been knocked down. Harry Reid has basically said Republicans won't give us 40 votes. They're filibustering it, and Republicans are going to run the Senate. Harry Reid decided, at the beginning of the year, and he's letting them run the Senate. So something to take up with Mr. Reid, I think. In the meantime, David Selig is with us. He is conservative commentator, pro-business advocate, TrueTaxHelp.com, his website over at Selig Associates. And, David, you wanted to talk about taxpayer anxiety disorder?
I do, Tom.
Now, I have this column here from the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. U.S. companies are making record profits. More of the money is staying offshore and lightly taxed. A Wall Street Journal analysis of 60 big U.S. companies found that together they parked a total of $166 billion offshore, shielding 40% of their annual profits from U.S. taxes. And in addition to doing that, they're buying back shares. Though it left the money off limits for paying dividends, buying back shares or making investments. In other words, the rich are getting richer. General Electric, $147 billion. Pfizer, $59 billion. Microsoft, $73 billion. Merck, $47 billion. Giant Jade, $67 billion. The top 1% own more than half of all the stock in the United States. 1% is doing just fine. Thank you very much. But not so much the average working person.
You make an excellent point, Tom. Here you've got these corporate fat cats getting away with something short of robbery. But the average person, or better yet, the higher achiever, they are really feeling the full force and effect of the government, who is wringing every last dime out of them. And what has happened, the issue that I'm on your show talking about today, is taxpayer anxiety disorder. Now, I know that at first blush, a lot of your listeners are going to say, this sounds like some sort of gambit.
I'd say a lot of my listeners would be very happy to become taxpayers. There is a frightening number of people, David, in the United States right now who are unemployed or underemployed, who are earning, considerably less than the roughly, $20,000-$25,000 a year that is the bottom, the top end of poverty
level. You're on point, Tom. You know, to quote one of your role models, Ronald Reagan, a rising tide lifts all boats. If we could just release some of these, onerous regulations, it would probably be a lot easier.
Yeah, although when Reagan said that, he was quoting Kennedy.
Mm. Okay, well done. One of the issues that we have that is affecting regular people, working people, small business owners, medical doctors in private practice and such, a lot of these people owe the government a great deal of money. And they're really suffering over this. They would like to come clean. The problem is when they do, they are hit with these debilitating, onerous penalties, a lot of interest. It feels as if they just cannot get out of it. Now, a lot of people say these same taxpayers are shirking their responsibilities. They're really not. It actually takes more effort and stress not to address this issue than it does to. What we're trying to do is work with the government and the psychiatric care community to recognize this issue and have the penalties abated. Because, Tom, that would go a long way in closing the tax gap.
So let me get this right, David. You're saying that if somebody earns their income in a way that isn't a regular wage, so it's not an ordinary deduction. I mean, for most taxpayers, this is an irrelevant issue because their taxes are deducted.
Because of the economy, the administration and such, they were forced to either sell stocks or perhaps break open that 401k, and now they got hit with those penalties, the early distribution penalties of 10%. Now, these are working salaried employees,
right.
And on top of that, they have the tax burden. And, Tom, they can't sleep at night. They are so racked with worry. Some of these people will have a generalized anxiety disorder.
You know what we need, David? We need a jubilee.
A jubilee. Do tell.
Well, it's, you know, in the Bible, this is for thousands of years. I mean, this is how Jewish society functioned. Was every 7 years you let the fields lay fallow so they could recover from the effects of agriculture, and on every 7 times 7th year, the 49th year, you would have the next year, the 50th year would be what's called the Jubilee year every 50 years, and all wealth was equalized. All the rich people gave all their money into the pot, and all the poor people gave all their money into the pot,
Tom,
and it all got split up equally among everybody, and all the slaves were freed. I beg your pardon?
You know, are you saying you want to give up your homes and such to the people who don't have, and then at the end of the day, what, we're all even?
Well, I'm not like, you know, Stephen Jay Helmsley sitting on lots and lots of homes.
Right. Well, I think you got two or three, right?
Louise and I are living on a boat here in D.C., and we've got a house in Portland that is for sale. We've been trying to sell it for 4 years. If anybody wants to buy a floating home in Portland, let me know. But we are not among the landed gentry, David.
Right.
But my point is that I think that even, you know, regardless of politics and regardless of economics and regardless of where you and I may stand in that whole economic pecking order, that what I'm suggesting is that we have $1 trillion in student loan debt. That's absurd, obscene, and frankly didn't even exist 30 years ago. The idea of student loan debt didn't happen.
So much interest on it.
Right. So we the people should simply step in and say, okay, that's $1 trillion. We're going to just write that off.
Okay.
So now you've got a generation that when they go to work, they can actually spend all of the money they earn. That's going to create demand in the economy, and that's going to stimulate the economy. Because right now they're using a lot of that money from, you know, people coming out of college, they get a job, they use a lot of that money to start paying down their debts. That doesn't stimulate the economy. It makes more money for Jamie Dimon, but not for everybody else.
I don't disagree with you,
okay.
Tom. I think that's outstanding.
Okay, so we do a debt jubilee for
the penalty portion on the taxes as
right.
well.
We do a debt and tax jubilee exactly on all student loan debt, number one. Number two, on housing debt. Let's say that all housing debt in excess of being underwater, in other words, you know, if your house is worth $200,000 and you owe more than $200,000, and let's actually make it like 15% less than underwater, because really nobody should buy a house without putting down at least 15%, or maybe 10%.
I don't know. I think you were right at 15 or 20, but okay.
Yeah, well, personally, I would like that, but let's just say 10% for even numbers. So if you have a house worth $200,000 and you got a $200,000 loan on it, we'll take $40,000 of that and write it off. And again, you know, we're going to write this off. Now, if that mortgage was involved at any point with any robo signing, and we know that hundreds of thousands of them were, if there was ever a robo signer involved in the process, the bank eats it.
Yeah, but Tom, we got to do something about the people who were real volunteers and not victims in this. Remember, not everybody had clean hands.
If there was no robo signer and somebody defrauded the bank.
Wait a minute now. You know, you had a lot of people who came to the table with no intention of honoring their contract.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I really don't think so.
We'll agree to disagree on that issue.
Okay. All right. David Selig, conservative commentator, pro-business advocate, his website, truetaxhelp.com. David, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm looking forward to being on your next show.
Thank you. Should we have a debt jubilee? Are David and I right? We should just write this stuff off.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Because this is like a giant load. It's an anchor around our neck as we're trying to swim across the Potomac River here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the rest of us. Yeah, really. And this whole Jubilee concept, I'm starting to actually be very serious about this. I've talked about the Jubilee for a long, long time. I mean, back in 1990, whatever it was, 1992, 94, 96, in that region when I was writing The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I think it was finally published in 96, as I recall. I was at some length, you know, there's actually a chapter in there in which I'm quoting Herman, forgetting his last name now, but he was the former president of the World Bank, and he wrote a book called Jubilee, and it was a book on how we should have a Jubilee. I mean, it's time for it. Let's do it. And it's just a couple of paragraphs in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, but it was in there. I mean, I've been rolling this around in my brain and in my policy suggestions for some time now. This forgiving debt. And the reason why I'm taking it really serious now is that between the time of the beginning of Reaganomics and today, which is basically, you know, the last 32 years, what has happened is that, as Elizabeth Warren pointed out a couple days ago, that productivity has continuously gone up. The American worker is producing more and more productivity, more and more profit for corporate America. And yet the wages have not gone up along with that productivity. Now, from the George Washington administration until the Ronald Reagan administration, wages and productivity pretty much always followed each other, with the exception of slavery, I mean, which is a whole different discussion. But people who worked for wages were basically paid based on their productivity. And as they became more productive, whether it was the result of innovation, whether it was the cotton gin or the railroad or the automobile or the industrial revolution or, you know, the oil, coal, whatever, or whether computers, or whether they became more productive simply because they worked harder. Regardless of what it was, as productivity went up, wages went up. And then came Reaganomics. We've had 30 years of Reaganomics, 32 years of Reaganomics. And during these 32 years, what has happened is wages have flattened out. They've been completely flat. Productivity has continued to increase. Now, in the space between the increased productivity, which is, in other words, making more money, and the flat wages, which is, in other words, workers not taking more money, the cost of things has gone up. The economy has, you know, we've had inflation for the last 32 years, but wages have been flat. People have wanted to have better lifestyles. They always did in the past, but they haven't. And so we filled in the gap, this giant hole that was created by the top 1% taking those trillions, literally trillions of dollars that were produced by the working class over the last 32 years in increased productivity, that trillions and trillions of dollars of profit that has been siphoned off by the top 1%. The way that working people have filled in that hole was first with credit. First, they ran up their credit card debt. And they did that. They did that from the 1980s up until, you know, from the beginning of the Reagan presidency, I mean, this is when people started filling in the hole with credit card debt. And through the 80s and the 90s, we saw an explosion of credit card debt during the Clinton years. And then in the early 2000s, after Phil Graham basically deregulated the banks, after we blew up Glass-Steagall with the Graham-Leach-Bliley in 1999, 2000, and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, people move from using their credit cards as a form of credit to using their homes as a form of credit. And so, you know, now they owe on their credit cards, and they owe on their homes, and their kids, or if they are kids, they owe on their student loans. We have a little less than $1 trillion in credit card debt in the United States, a little more than $1 trillion in student loan debt in the United States. And a total of $39 trillion in total public sector or private sector debt, total, you know, business plus consumer debt. It's a massive amount of debt. It is massively larger than our federal government debt that everybody's hysterical about. And if we don't start unwinding that debt, there's going to be an incredible crash. Because even if tomorrow the Obama administration, even if the progressive budget were to pass, the progressive caucus budget, which is being voted on, I believe, today. They were debating it yesterday. The vote was supposed to happen around 1 o'clock. I've been keeping track of this. I have not seen any evidence that the vote has happened. But even if the progressive budget was to pass, which puts 7 million people back to work, lowers unemployment, raises wages, stops the loopholes to offshore jobs, even if that passed, and the middle class started earning more wages, started getting some more of that productivity, it would be a decade before you saw the economy begin to recover. Why? Because it's going to take 10 years for people to pay down their damn debt. So if you want this economy to really come back, we got to do something about the debt. And, you know, $1 trillion in student loan debt, $1 trillion is nothing to the federal government. We could literally mint $1 trillion coin and say, we're going to pay off all the student loan debt in America with this tomorrow. And by the way, from now on, all student, you know, all college is free. We could do that. We essentially did that in the 1950s with the GI Bill. We sent an entire generation to college. We went from, 5-6% of our population being college educated, over 20% of our population being college educated. We could do that. It's going to take some serious political will. I think a jubilee is a good idea.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then we've got to seriously look at all this household debt and say, or, you know, homeowner debt and say, you know, we're going to jubilee a large chunk of that too. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And, well, the vote just happened. Well, it just happened. This is very interesting. There were two Democratic budgets. Budgets have to pass the House. Right? I mean, the House of Representatives, the Constitution says, because the House is, every single person in the House is up for re-election every 2 years. They are the closest to the people. And therefore, that's where all taxing and all spending must originate. It has to start in the House, then it goes to the Senate. This is what the Constitution says. And then if the Senate agrees on it, then it goes to the president for his signature. Now, I know that, you know, John Boehner's running around going, we're waiting for the president's budget. The Constitution doesn't say that the president has to produce a budget. In fact, it says the opposite. The House produces the budget. The president's job, the executive branch's job, is once the budget is done and has been signed into law, it's his job to make it happen. You got the money here now. You know, President, here's your defense part. Here's your EPA part. Here's your, fill in the blanks. You know, your Department of Agriculture, your Department of Education, whatever it may be. Go spend the money. Do it right. Accomplish the goals. But there were two Democratic budgets that were put forward. The Senate Democratic budget, which actually passed the United States Senate, was defeated by Republicans in the House, and 35 Democrats did not vote for it, which I find very interesting. These have to be Democrats who are in largely Republican districts who were worried that there were things in that budget that would be used against them in the elections, because keep in mind, people in the House of Representatives are the closest to, they're always the closest to the next election. They're always 2 years away, or less than 2 years away from the next election. And then the progressive budget came forward. Now, the Democratic budget got 154 votes. There's 189 Democrats, as I recall, in the House of Representatives, got 154 votes, so 35 of them did not vote for that. That's the Democratic budget. But it's still, you know, you had 261 Republicans voted against it, so it got killed. Because they really want Paul Ryan's budget, which turns, you know, Medicare into a voucher system and all that kind of thing. The Progressive Caucus budget was also rejected. That was only 84 Democratic votes, 327 votes against. Most of the Democrats, the majority of Democrats voted against the Progressive Caucus's budget, and all of the Republicans voted against it. That's really tragic. Although, here's the good news. Last year, the Progressive Caucus budget got 78 votes. This year, they got 84 votes. So they're growing. It's, you know, step by step. It's getting better, as they say. Dennis in Oxford, Georgia. Hey, Dennis, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about student loan debt?
Yes. Hi, Tom. I think the idea of a student loan jubilee is a good one, as long as it's extended only to or excluded for-profit schools. I think one of the real problems we've got is that the for-profits are sucking up a disproportionate amount of student loans, and while they account for only about 11% of students, as I understand, account for more than 50% of student loan defaults. So I think a jubilee that extended to nonprofits for-profits is a poor idea, but a great idea to extend it to nonprofits.
Well, they've already got the money. I mean, the debt is held not by the schools, it's held by the individuals. So, you know, we bail out the individuals, and then going forward, I think we should simply ban for-profit schools. You know, it used to be if you wanted to start a school, you had to incorporate as a 501c3, as an educational nonprofit. Let's go back to that.
I would really agree with that, because I sense that the ultimate purpose of most of the for-profit schools is simply to tap into student loan money.
I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, until the Reagan era, until the 80s, you know, nobody took for-profit schools seriously. They were generally referred to as diploma mills or thought of in those terms. I mean, there's just, you know, nobody wanted anything to do with for-profit schools. Dennis, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Mary Ann in Everett, Michigan. Hey, Mary Ann.
Hi, you old hippie. How are you doing today?
Fine.
So. Tom, I just have a couple of points. I usually agree with an awful lot of your issues and your stance on them, but having racked up a lot of money to go to school myself, I, number one, felt that it was kind of my, I don't know, responsibility to pay it back so that those programs would continue for future people.
Right.
I know the world is changing, but I just don't think dangling, like Jennifer Granholm back here in Michigan, they had a deal a few years back where everybody that graduated that wanted to go to school, when they graduated from high school, they automatically got, I can't remember, a certain amount of money, like $1,500 or $1,800,
sure,
you know, to help them out.
Yeah, when we lived
and
in Georgia,
a lot of people. I'm sorry.
When we lived in Georgia, there was something very similar. It's called the Hope Scholarships, and it was a couple thousand bucks.
Yeah, and what happened was a lot of people went, but when that ran out, they quit. They didn't finish their degrees. And I just kind of think maybe if they could figure out something to kind of a carrot, so to speak, to dangle.
Well, this is why I said the second half of it.
When you've actually achieved your goal.
Yeah, the first half is the jubilee. You say, okay, we're gonna cancel student loan debt. The second half is you say we're gonna join the other at least 32 of the other 34 OECD nations, the most the most developed nations in the world, and say that college education is free in the United States. I mean, it is our investment in our intellectual infrastructure. This is the infrastructure of this nation, is the next generation coming up. And
sure.
when we made a massive investment in our intellectual infrastructure. We've done it a couple of times in the United States. You know, Thomas Jefferson started the University of Virginia as a free school, and there were a number of free colleges that were founded during that era early 1800s. Then Abraham Lincoln did it again with the land grant colleges, giving massive chunks of land to universities that would be run by states, so much land that those universities could offer free tuition because they could make money with the land. They could graze cattle on it. They could sell timber off it. However they managed to do it, there was enough land that those colleges could actually offer free tuition. My mother graduated from one of those colleges, Michigan State University, land grant college. And
right,
that was Lincoln's idea. And then, you know, the third one was the GI Bill after World War II. And we sent millions and millions of returning GIs to college for free. And each time we made one of these large investments in the intellectual infrastructure of the United States, The consequence of the Jefferson era investment was that in the next generation, in the 1830s, in 1836, Alexis de Tocqueville comes over to the United States and travels around, and he's talking to average farmers out in their fields, and they're well informed on European politics. Blew his mind that the average American was so well informed. After Lincoln's investment, we saw the Industrial Revolution, the explosion, you know, technology and Thomas Edison, all this stuff. And then after the GI Bill, you saw the invention of transistors. And I mean, our investments in intellectual infrastructure have always paid off well.
I guess I just, from personal experience, I've just seen, in the healthcare industry at least, that when you give things, quote unquote, away for free, and it's not everybody, but there's quite a big number of people that when you ask to charge them for that same service or whatever down the line, they really, you know, they've gotten so used to not paying anything that they really balk at it. It's like they don't appreciate what you've been
doing. Well, I don't think there's anything free about an education. You've got to work your butt off to get through college. Or to get through trade school, for that matter. And I don't think there's
any.
And I've lived in countries where you know healthcare was free. Living in Germany, for example, you just show up. There's no copays. There's nothing. And that wasn't free either. I mean, it's no fun getting a shot or you know showing up at the hospital or having to sit.
Somebody somewhere is paying for it. Nothing is quote unquote free.
Obviously. But the experience, you know, I disagree that when, you know, I obviously I think that there are some examples and, you know, Ben Franklin in his autobiography talked about this at some length, you know, how the British welfare society was creating a class of people who were basically paid not to do anything and that was corrosive to society. And there is a small percentage of people who will live on the dole if the dole is good enough. That's something that we need to be on the alert for. But, you know, to think that everybody's going to do that or even more than 3 or 4% of the population might do that given the chance, history doesn't bear it out. You know, I'm just not so worried about that, frankly. I always
learn when I listen to you, whether it's just off television or talking to you. So I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you, Marianne.
Great talking with you.
Thank you. John in Sebring, Florida, you wanted to cap the debt jubilee?
Well, I don't have any debt. I'm living off IRAs and 401ks, and I'm not even 50 years old. Okay, so a jubilee is no help for me. Why don't we go as it's never going to happen anyway, but as long as we're wishing, let's go at it from the other way. Anybody who's worked as a worker and paid taxes as a worker for 10 years and they've never ever made 50 grand a year, we'll do just like Alaska does. We'll give you a certain amount of money, say 10 grand, 20 grand,
yeah.
50 grand.
Sarah Palin gave everybody in Alaska $2,000 a year, even children. So families would get $2,000, $4,000, $6,000, $8,000, $10,000. It's an interesting idea. Very socialist.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I wonder what people at CPAC would think about Sarah Palin's socialism. I'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where smart people get their news. And speaking of smart people, I'm pleased to have Elliot Richardson in the studio with me. He's an attorney. He's the president of the Small Business Advisory Council in Chicago. SmallBusinessAdvocacyCouncil.org is the website. Is it advocacy? Or
advocacy, Tom.
Advocacy.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I have the title wrong here.
No worries at all.
No problem. So Small Business Advocacy Council, you've been on the program before, but give us a quick recap of what you all do.
Yeah, you know, about 3 years ago, a group of folks just got frustrated with politics, basically, from a small business perspective. And we started this organization, and we advocate for small and mid-market businesses, laser-focused on empowering one another, passing legislation that is truly going to help small, not big business, and really pushing forward an agenda for our businesses, our employees, and for other folks.
Now, I understand one of the biggest problems that small businesses have in America is access to cash, you know, liquidity.
Absolutely.
Or access to debt, for that matter.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there's 20 banks in the SBAC. And
what's the SBAC?
Small Business Advocacy Council.
Okay, your group.
And, you know, if you talk to them, to a person, I believe they want to lend. And I'm talking about the people on the front lines. I'm talking about your branch managers.
Sure.
Not Jamie Dimon, not the people that are running the companies. But it's not happening. So, you know, one of the things we're pushing very hard is for crowdfunding, Tom. And that would allow our community to invest in our community. You know, you could raise $1 million from your friends, from your associates, from your business contacts. And we are just waiting for the SEC to write the rules to allow that to happen. It's called equity crowdfunding.
Well, if it's equity crowdfunding, then it's basically selling stock into the local community, is it not?
It is. It is. It, you know, so if you need a $300,000 loan or a $300,000 investment of some sort, what you need to do is you go to your friends, you go to your associates, you go to people who are willing to take a risk on you for $1,000, $2,000. You give them some of your company, but you raise that money that you need. It's a game changer for small businesses.
And all what you would have to do, presumably, for those people, and I've been through this with small businesses, having partners or bringing people in, is you have to say, okay, here is the value of this company based on our sales, and we're going to do a certain multiplier times revenue or a certain multiplier profit or, you know, assets plus however you value the company is a variety of different ways. And based on this valuation of the company, if you put 300 grand in, that represents 10% of the company, it represents 30% of the company, it represents 70% of the company.
Right.
And so I'm assuming that the reason you want the SEC involved is there really needs to be a neutral arbiter of the legitimacy of those valuations.
Well, right now you can't even do it. So right now you can't do an offering like this to a number of different people.
Right. The equivalent of an IPO. You can't do it unless you're Facebook.
Can't do it. But the Jobs Act, you know, President Obama's Jobs Act, which had bipartisan support, allowed for equity crowdfunding.
Really?
Oh, yeah. That's where this comes from.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's tremendous. Now, once the bill passed, they need to write the rules. And you know, I understand we have to give the SEC.
So the Jobs Act did pass Congress? I thought it.
Yeah.
Oh, it did? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, but they
have not implemented it.
Exactly. So we're waiting for the SEC to just draft the rules. They were supposed to be done in January.
Right.
You know, they needed an extension now. So we're really pushing them to do that as quickly as possible because there are businesses waiting to invest. I mean, waiting to hire, waiting to grow, and this is a tremendous way of doing it and adds competition to the banks. I mean, if we can invest in one another, all of a sudden, you know, we're not begging large venture capitalists and banks for a loan or for equity any way that we possibly can. We can come together through critical mass and get it done.
Right, and you can say, I patronize the dry cleaner down the street because I own 5% of his company.
Absolutely.
You know, that's my savings, and so I'm going to keep patronizing this, and I'm going to visit this drugstore down, you know, here or this restaurant because I own a piece of it, and that's my savings portfolio now as my local community.
It could be incredibly empowering. It could help local businesses, Tom. And, you know, we have to push hard because we don't have the money that the big corporations have. All we've got is critical mass saying, let's get it done.
Right. So, Elliot Richardson, you're doing this with the SmallBusinessAdvocacyCouncil.org in Chicago.
That is correct.
Are there other groups doing it around the United States based on the fact that the president's legislation has made this possible?
There are a lot of groups that are pushing crowdfunding, a lot of entrepreneurial groups that are pushing crowdfunding. I have to say, I mean, we've taken a pretty big lead on this just because we have such a dynamic organization and great people. And, you know, we're really moving a whole bunch of different things, this and health insurance and really pushing the agenda of small businesses forward.
Okay. Tell me about health insurance and small business.
Absolutely. I mean, health insurance rates kill small business. And unfortunately, one of the worst things I think that has come out of this whole Obamacare debate is small business owners forget that before this whole thing happened, our rates were still going up 15 to 30%.
I know it well. We provide health insurance for all our employees.
Absolutely. So it's not the Obamacare that's raised rates. It's that there's been four major insurance companies with no competition that have unilaterally been able to just do what they want. So one thing we've done in Illinois is we pushed very hard to have a law enacted that now has allowed there to be a health insurance cooperative in Illinois. And we were funded, not the SBAC, but a group was funded now to build that health insurance cooperative, and it's going to give small business owners the opportunity to compete with the four large insurance companies and try to build something better.
Is this the classic cooperative model where everybody who is a member actually is also an owner?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the people are going to use different sorts of, you know, the people running it are smart. They're going to use different sorts of mechanisms to bring down costs. And that's what's so exciting about it. And, you know, there are 26 states were funded for co-ops.
Right.
And you might not know this, in the fiscal cliff fiasco, the rest of that funding was taken away. So Illinois was the last state to actually get funded for a co-op, and we want to make this work because we want to show the insurance companies that we can do this and we can compete in the free market.
So if we do have that crash that I was talking with a caller a few minutes ago about, here are alternatives to traditional big-scale capitalism, which is small, local, free enterprise, basically.
I see amazing things happening in health insurance. I see third-party administrators and insurance brokers coming together to create products that are going to compete with the large insurance companies. It's very exciting. People are hungry for something different. They cannot afford, they just can't afford to continue to provide health insurance to their employees when rates go up 30%.
Yeah.
I see innovation. I see ingenuity. It's very, very exciting, and I'm optimistic that we're going to get something done.
I'm with you. Elliot Richardson, Small Business Advocacy Council.org is the website.
Yes.
The SBAC. And Elliot, I wish you the very best. Thanks for coming on and filling us in.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We'll be back.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There is a war going on in Seattle, Washington. A war between drivers and bikers. And I just find this fascinating. I remember when we lived in Portland. Portland is one of the more bike-friendly cities in the nation. And there's a fair amount of tension there. Here in D.C., they're building bike lanes. There's a fair number of bike lanes. You don't see anywhere near as many people on bicycles, though. And when you do, you clearly get the sense that they are taking their lives in their hands. Given the just general insanity of car traffic here, you know, just the nature of it. I mean, this is a city that was laid out for horses and buggies. It was laid out long before Henry Ford was even born. I mean, you know. So, in any case, Paul Guppy is on the line with us. He's the vice president for research at the Washington Policy Center, the pro-car side of the Seattle war on cars. If I'm characterizing this well. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, and greetings from Seattle.
Thank you. Would you disagree with my characterization up to this point?
Yes, I guess I would say it depends on what you mean by pro-car. I mean, we would agree with the more than 90% of citizens who travel every day by car. That's the statistic on daily trips. So the automobile is really essential to the life of our city and, in fact, every city in the modern world. So
right. It
has an important, I would say, central role. Bicycles are important as well, and I think they can peacefully coexist. The phrase war on cars, I think, refers not so much to tension between drivers and cyclists, by the way, who are often the same people. But in our city, the war on cars is by the mayor against drivers. So it's consistent public policy that works against the public interest.
So how is that playing out, in your opinion?
Pardon me?
How has the mayor declared war on drivers?
Basically by denying access to the public streets to automobiles. And what I'm referring to are arterials that are the lifeblood of our city. So we have wonderful parks. We have Alki Beach Drive and the Burke Gilman Trail, which are great places to go biking. But what the mayor has done is started to take general travel lanes in major arterial roads that are necessary for getting around and reserving a public right-of-way only for bicycles and buses while leaving general traffic with only one lane in each direction. So it's restricting the life of the city, the ability to move around our city.
So he's not actually taking those streets out of value for cars. He's just saying you have one lane or two lanes. You no longer have.
Well, he's reducing access to the public right of way by half.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
90% of the people who are trying to move around our city.
I'm not disagreeing with that. But 10% of the people who are moving around your city right now are doing it on bicycles, right?
No, I think that's only 1 or 2%. And
okay.
I'm being generous regarding our bus system. So we have a really good mass transit system, which carries, you know, 6-8% of daily trips, which is at the high end nationally.
So would it not?
Most people still travel by automobile.
Would it not be accurate to say that the mayor is doing this because if you bicycle, I'm thinking of Denmark. You know, Louise and I did this show for a week from Stockholm, and there are lots and lots of streets. And Stockholm is a major metropolitan city, and it's got its own traffic problems. Many of which come from, like I said, here in D.C., the fact that the city was laid out before there were cars. And there are streets that are almost entirely bicycles. And during rush hour, there's probably a 3-to-1 ratio of bicycles to cars on major streets in Stockholm. I mean, it was just amazing. And we were there in the winter, or in the fall, in September, October. Mm-hmm. And still, I mean, it rained almost every day we were there, and very cold rain, and still you'd see, you know, hundreds and hundreds of bicycles taking half of the road and dozens and dozens of cars. That has worked, and this is the result of the city of Stockholm. Stockholm is Sweden. It's not Stockholm. It's what's the capital of Denmark? Copenhagen. Thank you very much. This is the result of Copenhagen setting out an intentional policy of saying we're going to encourage bikes and discourage cars. And the consequences of this have not only been the pollution has dropped, but also the general health of the people has. We had one of the politicians who put this thing together on the program, and he said, you know, heart attack rates have dropped.
Sure. So if I could. Great point. So one thing I would point out is that one system or culture that might work for an older European city might not work for a newer Western city like ours. So Seattle, it's a beautiful area. Spring is starting today. It is gorgeous out here today. And Seattle historically is a garden city. So it is laid out in a way that's a much more open pattern of family development. That is single family homes in great neighborhoods, each of which has its own business district. A city like Copenhagen is much more densely packed with townhouses and flatter, and getting around on bicycle perhaps makes sense for those folks. What I'm saying is that what our mayor is doing is, on the one hand, increasing taxes, which I haven't even gotten to, raising taxes on drivers, and then using that money to take public access away from the traveling public,
right,
or the kind of city that we have. So he is gradually squeezing Seattle from being a garden city to a much denser city where it's harder to get around, and is creating a harsher urban environment, at least for the laid-back style that Seattle has had traditionally, is now becoming a much more crowded and denser place because of constricting the public roadways.
As there's more and more concern about the automobile as a, you know, being wasteful of energy, basically. I mean, you're moving 6,000 pounds of steel around just so that you can move your body around. Is there not a strong case to be made for moving as many people as possible to bicycles and mass transportation?
Yes, if that's people's choice. So for those who want to get around by bicycle, that's a good thing. The phrase war on cars comes from the fact that what the mayor is doing, with the support of the Cascade Bicycle Club, which is one of his major political supporters, is forcing people into a lifestyle that they haven't chosen. So he is using public resources in which to force his values on the people of the city.
Well, if people in the city don't like it, they'll vote the bomb out, right?
We may be doing that this year. So it's an election year. McGinn is not popular. He's running for re-election. And just like in the first time he ran, the Cascade Bicycle Club is going to be a key part of his coalition and for raising money and gaining support.
And I'm guessing you're going to be
in our city.
WashingtonPolicy.org is probably going to be part of his opposition.
Well, we're not a political organization. We're a research organization. We'll watch the race with interest from the sidelines, but we see the way his policies are changing the character of our city. So we're becoming less open, less of a garden city, and more of a dense, European-style, crowded urban city.
Has anybody ever asked you if you feel like a buggy whip manufacturer in 1915?
Not at all, because the buggy whip manufacturers went out of business because people voluntarily stopped buying their product. It didn't make sense anymore.
Right.
But as I mentioned, more than 90% of the people in the city choose to travel around by cars. Bikes are great.
In the 19-teens, we also started
many people.
But in the 19-teens, I mean, there were major battles. I mean, there were shooting wars in the 19-aughts and 19-teens about paving roads, because once you pave a road, you basically couldn't ride horses on it anymore. It would damage their hooves and or burn through their shoes more rapidly, and it was hard on the horses. But on the other hand, the cars needed paved roads. And I mean, this was a major war that happened. You go back and read the history of the first part of the 20th century and the last part of the 19th.
But what you're referring to is a natural cultural change based on choices that people were making.
But it was being made by government. I mean, the government was deciding which roads to pave for cars and which roads to leave dirt for horses.
What you're referring to are were changes made in society, often difficult because of choices people were making.
Yeah.
So people are not making a choice.
So you're not seeing an increasing proportion of people riding bicycles in Seattle.
Get around by car, and that's what we need.
Okay. So you're not seeing an increasing proportion of people riding bikes.
A tiny might increase from 2% to 4%.
I see.
Most people need to travel by car.
Okay. Paul Guppy, WashingtonPolicy.org.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fascinating conversation. We're going to hear from the bike side of this right after the break. So we heard, we're talking about the Washington City, Seattle, Washington's so-called war on cars, as it were. At least that's the frame that defined by the Washington Policy Center and Paul Guppy, who was just on telling us about how the mayor is beholden to the Cascade Bicycle Club and therefore is taking taxpayer money and turning roads into bike lanes. The humanity. Craig Benjamin on the line, public policy and government affairs manager for Cascade Bicycle Club. I guess Cascade.org is the website. I guess you can get it, and probably Paul got it from my questions, that I'm a little more with the bicyclists than with the car drivers, although I've never been a bicyclist of any consequence, just because it seems like a rational thing to do and because I saw what they had done in Copenhagen. But, Craig, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate being on your show today.
Thanks for joining us. How do you respond to Paul's assertion that the mayor is, you know, responding to 2% of Washington's commuters and, you know, taking a whack at 90% of Washington's commuters, the drivers?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing to understand is, you know, I love my car. Most Americans love my car. Heck, I'm going to hop in my car and drive 900 miles with my dog on a vacation on, you know, a classic American road trip tomorrow. So this isn't about anyone not liking cars. But here's the thing. Here in Seattle, families want to drive less, but many of them don't have alternatives. And 60% of people in Seattle want to bicycle more, but we haven't made the investments necessary for them to feel safe. And here in Seattle, we have all sorts of people working to make their neighborhoods better. We have a growing movement of neighbors working to create more neighborhood greenways, which are low-speed, low-traffic streets that are safer for families. We have a business community that's incredibly excited about making bicycling safer by physically protecting bike lanes from car traffic. There's caring moms and dads all over our city who are trying to ride with their kids to school. And our representatives are working hard to make our streets safer for everyone. And a lot of those improvements that Paul was talking about, those are actually pedestrian and traffic safety improvements that make the road safer for drivers, for people trying to cross the street, for people on transit, and as a side benefit, they make it slightly safer for folks to bicycle. And on the whole, what we've seen through surveys that have been done is that about two-thirds of the city are strongly supportive of providing people with more options for getting around, whether through transit, walking, or biking. And it's a significant minority that is interested in having us spend more money making it easier to drive.
So you said 60% of Seattleans. What's the word for Seattle residents?
Seattleites,
okay. 60% of Seattleites support more bike lanes. Where do you get that number from?
So recently, we were hearing a lot of this war on cars rhetoric that Paul was talking about and we've heard in the media, and there was a feeling that there might be some anti-bike sentiment out in the public. So we commissioned a poll, worked with a very well-respected firm, Fairbank, Maslin, Mullen, Messon Associates, to figure out how Seattle voters really feel about bicycling. And I want to be clear that we never intended to release any of these results publicly. we wanted to get an honest assessment of how people felt about bicycling. So we went out and asked very, very hard, very honest questions. And what we found is that there is no widespread anti-bike sentiment in Seattle, that in fact the data shows the complete opposite, that people view people who bicycle very favorably, in fact 78% of folks do, that policies that make it safer to bicycle, like neighborhood greenways or protected bike lanes, are overwhelmingly popular in the 70 to 80% range, and that this notion of the war on cars doesn't resonate at all. It resonates with less than 30% of voters. They're primarily older, white, conservative men. And I think the question sums it up really well. There was a forced choice question where it was, do you agree with this one or this one? And one asked people, do you prefer that we invest our money in making it easier for people to drive and get around our city because most people drive, as Paul mentioned? And the other said, people would like more options. We should invest our money in transit, walking, and biking, even if this means removing some on-street parking and some lanes in our roads. And that was two-thirds of voters supported that option.
Wow. That's pretty remarkable.
We were very pleased.
So is this playing, Craig Benjamin with Cascade.org, is this playing going to play a role in the mayoral election this year? The mayor's running for re-election?
Yeah, this will absolutely play a role. As Paul mentioned, we were strong supporters of the mayor in his last re-election cycle. I want to make it clear we have not made an endorsement this cycle. The mayor has been a supporter of bicycling, and that's something we're very excited about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the flip side is there's a lot of folks who want him to push harder.
Yeah.
There's lots of people who think he could do even more.
Now, when we were living in Portland, there were, at that time, this was a couple of years ago, there were a couple of streets that were being, you know, bike lanes were being expanded. The number of lanes available for car traffic was diminishing. There were a couple of instances of, you know, people throwing things out of cars, you know, water bottles and Coke cans kind of things, at bikers. Bikers flipping off drivers. I mean, there was some tension. It got played up, of course, and wildly blown out of proportion by the media, but it was there. Is that sort of thing going on in Seattle?
You know, we did feel some of that tension. I feel, and I think a lot of folks would agree, that it's died down in the last few years. We're a very polite city with Scandinavian roots, blue-collar roots. We tend to be on the politer side. Part of the challenge is the bicycling infrastructure we've built mixes people on bikes and cars. And that only works for a very small percentage of people who are comfortable riding with traffic. About 60% of folks, as I mentioned, want to ride more. We found that number in our survey in Seattle. That's very similar to numbers in Portland and other cities across the country.
Right.
But most folks, I'll take my wife for example, she's uncomfortable riding in traffic.
Yeah, well, in New York, I know, you know, 8th Avenue, one of my best friends lives on 8th Avenue down in the 20s. And the street out in front, they've now got concrete barriers where they've got, you know, one lane is not just for bikes, but you can't even get into it with a car.
Yeah, and where cities have built that type of infrastructure, they've seen dramatic increases in ridership.
Right.
All of a sudden, people feel safe, and they are safe.
So there's an element of if you build it, they will come.
Yes, if you build it right, people will ride.
Right. Amazing. Okay, Craig Benjamin, that website is Cascade.org, Policy and Government Affairs Manager for the Cascade Bicycle Club. Thank you, Craig.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Good talking to you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So should we be converting our cities into bicycle-friendly places aggressively, or should we be... No, I guess. Well, can bikers and drivers coexist? Can they live together? Is it possible? Could it be? It really seems to me that it needs to be one or the other. I know when we were living in Portland, it was my recollection, on average about once a month a biker got killed. And I remember when one of our kids, you know, was driving around on a bicycle all the time, and I was just, you know, constantly worried that she was going to get hit by a car. And yet, it's like incredibly healthy. And if you're living on a budget, as she was, it's a great way, you know, to get around, especially in a city, in an urban environment. So what do you do? I'm personally a fan of saying, okay, we're going to dial back on cars a little bit. And if somebody wants to drive around outside the city, fine. But inside the city, we're going to provide for transportation that is doesn't involve one person moving 6,000 pounds of steel or 3,000 pounds of steel. Now, Dennis in Seattle, I think you have a slightly different perspective on this. Hey, Dennis, thanks for calling.
Well, thanks. Hey, let me say a couple of things. I don't know where this guy is getting all his facts and figures from, but Seattle is a city that is constrained by two bodies of water, Puget Sound and Lake Washington. Plus, it has a whole bunch of hills. So the arterials are very limited in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And what the mayor has done, in a couple of instances, is taken what few arterials there are and reduce them down. And we're talking about tens of thousands of cars. There was a recent article about the number, the percentage of people who use bikes to get into work, and it's 2%.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's troubling about it is that there is a big homeless population in Seattle. A lot of those are veterans with PTSD. The mayor has made a conscious effort to spend millions and millions on bike paths. He just recently put in a bike bridge down on an area called Elliott so that bikers could jump over Elliott and reach a pathway alongside Puget Sound to bike on that cost $1 million. Meanwhile, he's not spending anywhere near that amount of money on these homeless vets who have PTSD. That, to me, is just wrong. The other thing is...
So, well, hang on just a second. This sort of seems like it's an apples and oranges argument. Do you think that it is the city's responsibility to deal with people who are veterans of war? Isn't that the Department of the Army's, you know, the Department of Defense's responsibility?
I think the city could provide some sort of shelters and not have them just out on the streets.
Because, you know, and similarly, are you arguing that the city can't walk and chew gum at the same time, basically?
There's only so much money to go around, right? Well, Seattle has problems with budget.
Every city has problems with budgets, especially when unemployment is up and times are tight.
Right, times are tight, so there's a limited amount of budget. So now you have to make a choice, and you have to decide what is your priority.
Right. Do we move Seattle into the 21st century and make it a more bike-friendly and low-carbon and low-environmental impact city, or do we keep it in the 19th century or the 20th century, actually, arguably, and keep feeding the cars? I mean, you're talking about the arteries, the major arteries. You're not talking about, you know, roads off, you know, ramps, primary roads, ramps and roads off of highways here.
Arteries, I'm talking about...
You're talking about major streets.
I'm talking about streets that have 10, 12,000 cars per day.
Right, major streets.
All right, and there's not very many of them.
And they're chopping back one lane to provide that for bicycles.
Well, what he's done is, in the case of what's called Elliott and 15th, what he's done is, there used to be three lanes. He's cut it down to two.
Right.
Okay. And in the case of some minor arterials like Nickerson, there used to be four lanes. He's cut that down to two. The shame of that is that people don't even bother to, the bikers don't even use Nickerson. They go over to what's called the Ship Canal, and they use a path along the Ship Canal. So even though he's spent, I don't know, a few hundred thousand dollars to modify Nickerson,
right,
to have bike lanes.
You sound to us like you've really done your research on this. Would you work with one of these conservative groups that's opposed to the bikes?
I'm progressive as all get out. That's why I'm bothered by the fact that we have homeless vets that we're not spending money on, and at least trying to get a roof over their head.
Sounds like
And the other thing about bikes.
Sounds like a phony area. But Dennis,
it's not phony. I don't.
All right. Okay. I'll take you at your word. Dennis, thank you for the call. Let's get some other voices in here. Joe in Olcott, New York. Hey, Joe, you want to talk about cars and bikes?
Hey, Tom. This boils down to a center city model compared to an urban sprawl model.
Okay.
And
explain what those mean.
Is that a lot of people nowadays have to drive 25, 30 miles for work because they can't afford to live in the center city anymore.
Right.
And in my personal opinion, Seattle has every right to say, you know what? This is the amount of traffic we're going to allow in the city. You have to come from outside the city, then we'll supply mass transit to bring you into your point of destination. And let the people in the city ride their bicycles.
Okay, so you're, I by and large, I agree with your perspective, but the ultimate thing here, which the earlier caller, the point was not making, is that the people are going to make the decision. I mean, if the mayor's policy is not popular, he won't get reelected. If the city council's policy is not popular, they won't get reelected. On the other hand,
well, that's called term limits. They don't like what he did, they throw him out. If
that's
they
right.
like what he did,
that's right.
there's going to be the groundswell to take and reelect the gentleman.
Unless some cranky billionaire gets involved, you know, now that Citizens United is in place and one of these, you know, right-wing think tank research institute, whatever, gets involved.
At that point, faith has to come into the matter and say, you know what, no matter how much money's thrown at me, my voice is going to have to carry because it's the right thing to do.
Okay. All right. So, Joe, you sound like one of these big government liberals who has decided that you know what's the best for everybody.
No, I just know what's best for each individual town to decide for itself.
Yeah, I was being facetious. Although that is what would have been said had you called into the Limbaugh show. But I by and large agree with you. Joe, thank you for the call. Well said. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia, you wanted to talk about this.
Yeah, I've got Antioch and Waterfall Road up here, which are like one-lane roads that somebody mistakenly painted a center line down. There's no shoulders. There's a six-foot drop off of them. And then for some reason, the bicyclists seem to be coming up and down, preventing me from getting in and out of my house. Now, on 15, there's a bike path. It's a six-lane road with a bike path.
Right.
Since they built 66, 55 doesn't get driven on. So they've got a perfectly wide road with shoulders on it. It's safe, and it's perfect, but they want to try to make me decide whether or not to run them over or involve myself in a head-on collision. And I refuse to run over them. But, you know, my other point is...
So are you suggesting, Steve, that we should say to bikers, you must use the bike lanes. You cannot ride. You cannot coexist with traffic.
Well, it's not that they cannot coexist with traffic. It's just that what they're doing is incredibly unwise. The other night I was coming home and there was a guy in a black suit in the dark, on a bicycle with no lights.
Yeah, this
suicidal is what he was.
Yeah, that's the Darwin Award. That's a Darwin Award stuff. You know, that's
exactly. And like I say, there are two roads parallel to both of these that are perfectly safe for bicycles. Go over there and ride your bicycles. It doesn't have a wine. Then they drink wine. They come up and drink wine, and then they go out on the road with bicycles.
Okay, Steve.
The worst thing is, I built Antioch Road.
Uh huh. You built
it? You know, I'm not too pleased with the whole situation.
How'd you build it?
I had a quarry, and I donated the stone. Huh. And the state built the road up to where it is right now, but at least now it's no longer a one-lane road, although the width is the same.
Right. Interesting. Very interesting. Thanks a lot for the call, Steve. Thanks for your perspective. Philip in Colton, Oregon. Hey, Philip, got a minute to the break.
Yeah. I deal with bicycles, you know, a lot in downtown Portland. Most of them are, you know, messenger bicycles, and they're rude. And I've run in with other bicycles around the city, you know. I see them run red lights, and I sit and I wait, and I go through the light, and I ask one person, kind of alongside him, why'd you run the light? And he threw his water bottle at my car.
Police will give in Portland. I know from personal experience in Portland that bicycle riders will get tickets for running red lights.
Well, not downtown Portland, they don't.
Well, if they see them, they will.
I used to drive my wife back and forth. I'm disabled. I used to drive her back and forth to work a lot, and I had to deal with this driving through the city.
Yeah. So you're not a fan of bikers. So should they have their own streets?
I'm okay with them. If they live within the law.
Yeah.
See, I pay taxes, gas tax for the road.
Right.
They don't pay tax
Okay, so we should figure out a way for bicyclists to pay a tax for the roads that they're using. It's an interesting concept. Philip, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There probably is a point to be made that a gasoline tax is what funds at least a large chunk of the roads. Should there be a tax on bicycle registration, maybe? Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Talk Radio News Service brought to you by Sideswipe, Bob Ney's new book, Lessons Learned Courtesy of the Hitmen on Capitol Hill, and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So, what's going on in the world today? I understand the progressive budget got knocked down in the House of Representatives.
Yes, the progressive budget predictably did get knocked down in the House of Representatives, and the Ryan budget will prevail. But these budgets are aspirational. They ultimately don't mean anything in the same way that Patty Murray's budget will probably pass in the Senate. And it is on the way because they have apparently reached a deal on the spending bill to fund the government, which is going to run out of money on March the 27th. So that will move forward. And then they'll start work on the budget probably tomorrow, maybe even later today. And then they'll finish everything up by the end of this week. But the progressive budget, no, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, and the they got a half a dozen more votes than they did last year. I mean, the progressive budget is we're moving in the right direction from my point of view. You know, it's getting more and more people involved in it. And the Patty Murray budget, the Democrats' budget that is before the Senate, that was brought up in the House today and also voted down. Correct.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. So you think that the Paul Ryan budget is going to pass? All the Republicans are going to salute that flag?
Well,
yes,
I mean,
let's voucherize Medicare.
Not everybody did vote for the Paul Ryan budget, but my understanding is that that just about everybody is on board with it. Just about most of the Republicans are on board with it. I did read rather a complicated article earlier today that I didn't entirely understand about how Democrats are thinking of doing some quite clever maneuvering in terms of their posturing on the floor, but ultimately it isn't going to probably make any difference that the Ryan budget is going to be the Ryan budget. But as I said, these things are, they're positional.
Right. The Ryan budget is dead in the Senate, even if it passes the House. But if it does pass the House, you're going to have a majority of the Republicans on record for turning Medicare into a voucher system. For, you know, cutting benefits of retirees and poor people and children and hungry people and unemployed people, and for cutting taxes of wealthy people and raising taxes of working class people.
I mean, right. That's exactly what you're going to be doing. And in fact, faith groups today have been holding protest actions across the country, calling on Congress to pass a budget that invests in programs to help low-income Americans instead of giving tax breaks to the wealthy and corporations. Faith in Public Life is holding 21 events in 13 states, encouraging Congress to protect families and seniors, reject austerity, and remind them we have enough for all in this country. They're going to be delivering loaves of bread and fish to Congress.
Isn't that largely the message of the new Pope? I mean, he hasn't called out Paul Ryan the way the nuns on the bus have, but he's saying make poverty a priority.
Yes, and, you know, it's who knows whether he might at some point do that. He can be quite an outspoken guy.
Yeah.
Look at his previous position on the Falkland Islands, she said meaningfully.
Interesting. Well, Pope John Paul II called out George W. Bush specifically with regard to the war in Iraq.
That's right. So we don't know what he's going to do. I mean, he hasn't taken any overtly political positions yet. But he might do. He might do. I mean, he's only had his cape and his ring and stuff for a day or so. He's got to sort out the curia in the Vatican, and that's a full-time job.
Yeah, he's got a lot on his plate. So what else is going on in the world other than Barack Obama's car croaking in Israel?
The car croaked. It went crazy on Twitter in Israel. They started naming the car. It was trending at number 3 on Twitter, I believe. The President and Prime Minister Netanyahu held a joint press conference this afternoon, and if it ever needed to be put to rest, I have never seen, and I've been to a few press conferences, I have never seen a foreign leader more fervently, verbally embrace President Obama than Benjamin Netanyahu did this afternoon.
Really?
It was quite extraordinary.
Well, what happened to this whole right-wing, you know, story that I've been reading on all the right-wing websites for years now and that I hear from my right-wing radio colleagues when I go to the radio conventions or when I debate them, that Netanyahu hates Obama and Israel hates Obama and vice versa and quack, quack, quack. What happened to that?
They may claim that he was putting on an act today, but if so, he should have gotten an award because it was quite extraordinary. And he not only praised Israel, the United States' support for Israel, but he praised Obama personally for his support and that no president has done this kind of support before. It was really quite effusive, but not effusive in an over-the-top kind of way,
right,
but in a really sincere way, in a way of saying, I am driving this point home. I want everybody to hear this.
Wow.
The first question was about the alleged chemical attack in Syria yesterday. The president took that question and was very clear. He said he was deeply skeptical of the government of Syria's assertion that the rebels had deployed those weapons.
Yeah.
Deeply skeptical.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense that if the government controls the stockpiles of the weapons, of chemical weapons, and chemical weapons are used, you know, that the government did. And plus, this is a government that has already committed numerous atrocities. I mean, this is so.
Right. He said that we're looking for the facts, but if chemical weapons have been used, it would be a game changer, and he would take action. But he would not specify what the action is.
Interesting.
So that was highly significant. I thought it was extremely interesting. Also today, very briefly, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is facing blowback from Senator Barbara Boxer, chairman of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, for his decision to delay a key but expensive safety rule proposed in the aftermath of the 2011 Fukushima meltdown. The five-member commission voted this week to postpone consideration of regulations requiring new vent filter systems on 31 nuclear reactors that are similar in design to the Japanese power plant where the accident took place. Instead, they decided to give itself a year to produce an evaluation, gather public input. Barbara Boxer said, we should accept the recommendations of safety experts and not just accept the partial fix.
Yeah.
They should never cut corners.
Well, and just the fact that we still have over 30 of these old Mark I GE reactors is scary enough. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is absolutely fascinating. In Cyprus, you know, Cyprus is this little island kind of off the coast of Greece that is its own nation state. And it's a member of the European Union. They use the euro as their currency. And like pretty much all the rest of the European countries, with the exception of Germany, which has been able to protect their exports with their VAT taxes and has been able to protect their wages of their workers by a constitutional requirement that any company with over 1,000 people, 1,000 employees, has to have 50% of their board of directors made up of representatives of organized labor. Outside of Germany, pretty much every other country in the EU is in trouble. And the reason why they're in trouble is they no longer control their own currency. Now, you could say, well, you know, Mississippi doesn't control their own currency. They don't seem to be in trouble. Well, the federal government bails out Mississippi every year. For every dollar Mississippi sends to Washington, D.C., they get back $1.20 or thereabouts, you know, something in that neighborhood. And everybody, for every dollar people in New York State send to Washington, D.C., they get back 80 cents. Why? Because some of it's going to Mississippi. But you don't see New York State saying, damn it, we want that money from Mississippi. And in fact, we want Mississippi to start selling off their streets or their, you know, parks or their historic monuments in order to raise the money to return that money to us. You don't see New York saying that to Mississippi. Because we are one country, the United States of America. Europe is not one country. It is a, the EU is a union of individual sovereign states. And so each one of these states is run its own way in response to its own people, you know, with their own politics, their own, in many cases, their own language. But they share a common currency and they can, and a common European Central Bank. And because they share a common currency, when a recession happens and the automatic stabilizers kick in, when unemployment goes up 2 or 3% in, say, Cyprus, and the government has to go, has no choice. Unemployment has gone up because we're in a, the business cycle. This is capitalism 101, right? You're going to have capitalism. You're going to have business cycles. You're going to have boom and bust. It just happens. Business cycle goes down. The automatic stabilizers kick in. The automatic stabilizer, the principal one, being unemployment insurance. So some small fraction, some percentage of Cypriots, of people who live in Cyprus, have gone from being payers of taxes because they had jobs to being takers of tax money because now they're unemployed. So the government has less income and higher expenses. What does that mean? They run a debt. Now, when they control their own currency and they can simply issue their own currency, they can pay, they could just print more money to pay off their debt. Or they could run up the debt in their own currency and they don't have to answer to anybody for it. And should the day ever come, they could monetize that debt if they choose to. They could say, okay, we're going to have gradual inflation over a period of 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, as we've done in the United States, to pay off the debt with cheaper dollars. Or we can do it very, very quickly, which typically is not done. Generally governments don't do that. Or we can even change it. I was in Israel back in the 80s, I think it is, when the new shekels replaced the old shekels. If you had a 100 shekel note, it suddenly became a 10 shekel note. They just dropped a zero off everything. So there's a variety of ways that if you control your own currency, you can change, you can do this. But Cyprus, because they're part of the European Union, because they have to use the euro, they don't control their own currency. So when the banksters, who collectively own the European Central Bank, just like our central bank, our Fed, is owned by the big banks. There are actually 12 Federal Reserve banks, the First Bank of Boston, and then there's smaller banks that own stock in them. And so, but in any case, our Fed is owned by banks. There, the European Central Bank is owned by the banks. And the banks say, you guys are running up a debt. You got to pay it off right now, Cyprus. Now, Cyprus has been, their principal business, given that they don't have a lot of natural resources and they don't have a lot of factories, their two principal businesses have been tourism and banking. It's very much like the Cayman Islands or the Bahamas or Bermuda. Tourism and banking, actually other order, banking and tourism. And since banking is one of their major businesses, they have very low tax rates to encourage people to bank with them. And so a lot of people from around the world, especially Russians for some reason, but a lot of people from around the world stash their money in Cypriot bank, in Cyprus's banks, Cyprian banks, I guess you would say, to shelter it from local taxes. So the German banks and the Germans are saying, you guys, we're helping you out. We're loaning you money so that you can pay your unemployment insurance, because this is a recession that was caused by our banksters. But we want the money back. So what we want you to do is go to everybody who has a checking account, since your principal business is banking, after all. I want you to go to everybody who has a checking account, and if they have less than 20,000 euros, less than $30,000 in that checking account, pull 6.5% thereabouts percent out and just give it to us. And if they have over 20,000 euros in their checking account, pull about 9.5% out and just give it to us. We're just going to take it. This was the proposal. It went before the Cypriot, the Cyprian Cyprus's parliament. The people overwhelmingly opposed it. Parliament said no yesterday. And the banks in Cyprus are closed. They're having a bank holiday right now because they're afraid that now that this even came up for a vote, everybody's going to try and get all their money out of the Cyprus banks. So that's it. I'm out of here. Meanwhile, in Spain, the banksters are saying, you know, you got to pay us back, so stop giving people unemployment benefits. In Greece, they're saying you got to pay us back, so cut back on health insurance benefits. So in Greece now, if you've been unemployed for more than a year, you no longer have free health care. Story in the New York Times that I shared with you a few weeks ago about a doctor saying he had a woman patient come in. She had breast cancer that had burst through the skin. Her breast was actually oozing from the cancer. He said, I've never seen this in my life. This is not the kind of thing you see in a developed country. This is the kind of thing you see in a country where there's, you know, this is the kind of thing you see in third world countries. And it's happening in Greece because people can't afford to go to the doctor. And this woman was just hoping there was a pimple. It was cancer. But the banksters are getting paid. This is Europe on the edge of a breakdown. Meanwhile, here in the United States, mark my words, we're going to see unemployment go back up a little bit because this austerity is kicking in, right? The so-called sequester. It's cutting back on government spending. Well, you know, average people don't have money to spend. That's what creates demand in the economy. Average people don't have money to spend. So government spending fills in the gap. Well, you know, if you go along with the Republican deal, John Boehner getting 98% of what he wanted, government spending goes down. So does the economy. And then meanwhile, they've got a housing bubble in China that makes our housing bubble in 2006 look like nothing. And that's about to pop. But what do we do? We'll talk about that in a minute.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There are a variety of options to avoid disaster or to deal with it all around the world. I'll share them with you after this. Here in the United States, we're looking at this disaster as a consequence of Reaganomics. How do we deal with that? In Europe, they're dealing with a disaster, which is the consequence of a terribly misguided policy of integrating the Eurozone economically. It's like great for the banksters, bad for everybody else, but not integrating them politically. And so, you know, you've got states that are making out very well, and you've got states that are just being brutalized. And then in Asia, you've got China principally, but also South Korea and Japan to a lesser extent. You've got housing bubbles. You've got, you know, situations that are the consequence of so-called global free trade that are building these countries but have their own cycles and their own dangers built into them. I think step number one, one of the most important things that we need to do is educate people about economics. People, I mean, just simple stuff. I've been talking about this for you know, the decade we've been doing this show, forever. Right? But it's like, and I've been writing books about it for a lot longer than that. We need to educate people about basic economics. When Reagan came along and said, oh, supply-side economics, that's a cool idea, he had no idea what he was talking about. There's no such thing as supply-side economics. The whole Reaganomics idea of, you know, if we make it easier on the rich and we let the rich get massively richer, somehow that's going to trickle down to all the rest of us, it's just created a nation of peons. It doesn't, you know, it does not work. It has devastated the American middle class. And here's the bad news. The American middle class is wiped out, and the American middle class is what drives the economy. Now, I realize there's a lot of billionaires who say, well, I got mine. But there's a lot of people on the high end of middle and the low end of rich who are really going to get screwed by this. And they don't realize it. They think they got theirs. People making $150,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year, or who've got, you know, a couple hundred thousand bucks stashed away, and they think, ah, this is Fat City. No. That's a very dangerous place to be. And then there's a very large proportion of the American population that are just getting by, that are living right on the edge, that have run up their credit cards, that have run up their mortgages, that have, you know, if they lose their health insurance, they get one serious illness, they lose their job, they're homeless. So what do we do about this? Well, for the Europeans, I would say dissolve the European Union, dissolve the euro tomorrow. Just let countries go back to having their own currencies. It was an experiment. You tried it for a couple of decades. Didn't work out so well. Nearly, you know, I'm telling you, if mark my words, five years from now, we'll have this conversation again. God willing. And if the European Union is not substantially dissolved, or countries are not allowed to have their own currencies, within 5 years, you're going to see war in Europe. And I don't say that lightly. With regard to the countries of Asia who are piling up these massive trade surpluses, we need to, what's in their best interest and the best interest of the rest of the world, is for all the countries of the world to start renouncing these free trade agreements and saying, you know, Ross Perot was right. He was a crazy old coot, but he was right. And nations should have economic semi-permeable membranes that are called trade policies. And the trade policy that each nation creates should be one unique to that nation that works to the best interest of that nation. Period. And then with regard to the United States, how do we fix it here? We have to educate people to the fact that we have tried a radical experiment for 32 years. You won't even hear this in the news. And, you know, every economist knows this. This is not a secret. The right-wing economists brag about it. The left-wing economists are freaked out about it. But they all know it. For 32 years, we have been doing an experiment. And by the way, the British economists know it as well, because the Brits have been doing this along with us. Margaret Thatcher started it 2 years before Ronald Reagan did. And this Thatcheronomics, Reaganomics, austerity-nomics, smaller government, well, the Warren Harding in 1920, when he ran for president of the United States, his slogan was, less government in business, more business in government. Right? That's the essence of Reaganomics. And it has failed. And it's time to say that, to just acknowledge that, to say these economic policies that only benefit the rich and the multinational corporations, and the multinational corporations part has been principally our trade policies, but the economic policies, principally our taxation policies, have not worked. And we need to go back to the taxation policies that we had in the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s that did work. And we need to have a strong social safety net. Instead of talking about chain CPI and cutting back on Social Security, we need to be talking about lifting the cap on who pays into Social Security, so wealthy people pay into Social Security too, and raising the benefits that people get out of Social Security. Instead of talking about raising the retirement age from 65, we need to be talking about dropping the retirement age down to 60 so that more people will get out of the job market. You know, about half of the people between 60 and 65 would probably retire. In fact, I'd take it down to 55, frankly, but let's say 60. Half those people retire, half of them stay working. It's an optional thing. The half who retire, they're going to open up all these jobs for young people. Suddenly there's going to be competition among employers for young people working for them. That'll drive up wages. Drive up wages, tax collections go up, the economy gets better.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Not only does the economy get better, but tax revenues are increasing and your deficits go down. Everything gets fixed. the very, very nathonically ugly, the good. Aaron Jackson. Jackson, an activist and director of PlantingPeace.org, is literally bringing the fight against bigotry to the front door of one of America's most homophobic organizations, the Westboro Baptist Church. After looking up the church's Topeka, Kansas headquarters, he realized that the house across the street was for sale. It was an opportunity too good to be true. Jackson and his organization purchased the house, now called the Equality House, and decorated it with the colors of the gay pride flag. Although the Westboro Baptist Church has released a profanity-filled statement about their new neighbors, Jackson says the rest of the Topeka community has responded positively to the Equality House. Good work, Aaron. It's more proof that nothing fights bad speech better than good speech. The bad. James Ives. Ives, the head of the Texas-based Great Fort Bend County Tea Party, doesn't like the government. Or democracy, for that matter. According to a recent report from the Texas Tribune, Ives was a high-ranking member of the American Fascist Party until at least 2003. Although Ives says his time with the Mussolini-loving AFP was just a joke, his posts on its message board seem pretty serious. Texas Tribune has uncovered this telling quote, quote, "It will be our greatest challenge and our sweetest victory to finally surpass this dark menace, this numbing threat from the shadows, and replace it with the pure sunbeam that is our fascist faith, our fascist truth," end quote. The Tribune's scoop on Ives is a reminder that right-wing hate groups are at an all-time high right now. Political fringe is probably a bit closer to mainstream parties than we'd like to think. And the very, very ugly Joseph D. McDonald. McDonald, the sheriff of Plymouth County, Massachusetts, dug himself into a deeper hole Tuesday when he tried to defend a joke he made Sunday about assassinating President Obama. In McDonald's joke, Obama asked the ghost of Abraham Lincoln how he can best serve his country, and Lincoln responds, "Go to the theater." Lincoln, of course, was killed at Ford's Theater here in Washington, D.C. During the inevitable firestorm following his comments, McDonald accused his critics of acting like Nazis in 1938 Germany. Because, you know, calling out a law enforcement official for essentially justifying the assassination of the president, that's the same thing as fascism. The fact that McDonald, a public servant, is unable to see any problem with his joke and then laughs off his critics, that is very, very ugly. So, what do you think about my solutions to the world, the world's problems? We've got, you know, Econ 101. Let's just teach people economics. If every one of you watching or listening was to make it your personal mission to explain to at least one other person over the course of the next week, and maybe four or five people over the course of the next few months, how economics works. That economics are driven by demand. That the real job creators are people who buy things. That people are more of a job creator if they spend 100% of their paycheck, and less of a job creator if they spend less than 100% of their paycheck. Right? Mitt Romney taking $20 million and putting $19 million of it in a Swiss bank account, that's not much of a job creator. But somebody on unemployment who gets a $300 check a week and spends 100% of it, all $300, that $300 is going into the economy and it is going to create jobs. It's demand. So if you just, explain it to somebody. Explain to them that the trade policies that we've had since Reagan are, arguably since Nixon, this whole most favored nation status thing. I mean, that's really where it all started. Nixon opening us to China on behalf of Pepsi, actually. A corporate-sponsored president. Probably not our first, but the first that we definitely know about. That, Perot was right. Dumb ideas. Keith in Seattle, listening on KBCS. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, great for Elizabeth Warren. I have a wonderfully simple 30-word question for economists posed by the founder of Adbusters. I think you know that group.
Kelly Lessen is his name, or Callie Lessen.
L-A-S-N is the spelling. Yeah. And he also coined the phrase, or helped coin Occupy Wall Street. I didn't realize
that. Yeah, he did coin that. I used to write, it's been several years now, but I used to write for Adbusters. It was a great group, yeah. A great magazine, great publication.
Well, there's a new book called Meme Wars, M-E-M-E, The Creative Destruction of Neoclassical Economics.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blast at predatory corporate top-down dark money, interest-driven capitalism, and the need to throw it out and find a human alternative. But his question is simple.
Did Kelly write that book?
Pardon?
Did Kelly Lasson write that book?
He wrote part of it. There's a lot of essays in it, but he wrote part of it.
Cool.
But it's for economic students, which is kind of the book is aimed at.
Right.
And it simply says, here's the, ask your professor this question. What is the ultimate responsibility of economists?
Mm-hmm.
Is it to do no harm? Is it to manage our planetary household in a responsible way to make sure the human race survives?
Right.
Simple and profound.
Yep. Let's establish our priorities. And, you know, should making money be our first priority, or should, you know, it used to be up until the 1890s, in every state in the union, the state charter laws by which a corporation was chartered required that the first statement of purpose of every corporation created in every state in the country was the purpose of this corporation is to serve the public good. This corporation will serve the public good by manufacturing railroad cars. You know, but that was their first statement, was it had to be, and it no longer is. And it should, you know, we should go back to it, because that was the basis that secretaries of state used to give out the corporate death penalty to corporations. You know, they simply say, you're not serving the public good anymore, and you're out of here.
Corporations are to serve us. We're not supposed to serve them.
Yeah, excellent point. Keith, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to KBCS. Andy in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. So I was going to call in and comment on the biblical jubilee system to kind of add to some of this talk about the jubilee that you had.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually am an urban planner, so I kind of want to comment on the bike thing, too. just to say that, you know, only 70% of people in this country have a driver's license. And those 30% are those most vulnerable, their children. And they're elderly and they're poor people and disabled people. And so the public right-of-way really needs to be constructed to serve the public. So that's my elevator speech on bicycles.
Okay. Noted and well
anyway,
taken.
But I wanted to let you know about a book that I really enjoy by a theologian named Ched Myers,
mm-hmm.
called The Biblical Vision of Sabbath Economics.
Hmm.
And he really ties together Scripture, which is a tough thing to do if you've ever tried to, you know, hack into the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But he really it talks about this jubilee system that the ancient Jewish people had,
right.
That every 50 years or so, all the land goes back to the original tribes. There's distribution of wealth there. The land lays fallow. I think there's ecological.
Yeah, that was every 7 years that you had to let your field have a break. But yeah.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah.
The 50-year thing was all wealth was equalized and all the slaves were freed.
Right. And this theologian, Ched Myers, writes that you can't really understand Jesus's life and ministry if you don't understand that system, because that's exactly what he was talking to.
Hmm.
And all of his parables have an economic underpinning. And it's very exciting stuff. If there's any of your listeners that are progressive Christians,
yeah.
And
well, let me just to that, whether somebody listening is a Christian or whether they're not, and if they ever have interactions with Christians, many times I've gone off on Matthew 25, which is the place in the Bible where you know, the disciples come to Jesus and say, "How do we get into heaven?" And he says, "In the last days, I'm going to be sitting on the throne, separating the sheep from the goats, the sheep being right. The ones going to heaven and the goats being the ones going to hell." And you know, the criteria is going to be, when I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was thirsty, did you give me water? When I was in prison, did you visit me? When I was sick, did you heal me? When I was naked, did you clothe me? And the disciples freak out saying, "Well, we never saw you hungry. We never saw you sick. How can, you know, so we're screwed. We're not going to make it into heaven." And he says, "As you did to the least among you, you did unto me." The interesting thing is, if you look that up in Matthew 25, I think it starts like in the 19th verse or thereabouts. It's about halfway through the chapter. He actually says that, you know, in the time of judgment, he will be sitting on the throne and will bring before him the nations. And he will separate the nations, as sheep and goats. And so literally, and this has been the basis of a lot of Catholic theology for a lot of years, and I mean, there's been a debate within the Catholic Church about this as well, and it goes back to St. Thomas Aquinas, but it has been completely lost on much of the Protestant Church, is that you could argue, and I think you could make a very, very strong argument, that this Christian basis, that what Jesus was saying was, the nations will be judged on whether or not they fed their hungry, they gave water to their thirsty, they healed their sick, they gave shelter to their homeless, and they, you know, took care of those who were in prison appropriately. Because it's right there. You read it, and it's like it just hits you like right in the forehead. Wow. He doesn't say the individuals. He doesn't say the people. He says the nations. So, anyhow, Andy, thanks for the call, and thanks for giving me an opportunity to riff on one of my favorite Bible verses. We'll be back 15 minutes before you go.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yes, the nations shall be judged. Somebody quick call the Republicans and tell them. It's in the Bible. Hey, if you've noticed on our website and on our message, on our newsletter, that there's a little Aeroside banner on there. I have been using this thing for a couple of months now. Louise and I have been using it in the bedroom in our boat, and I no longer wake up with the stuffy nose. I just find it amazing. Just wanted to let you know. Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, we've covered a lot of territory today. Timothy in Columbus, Ohio, you wanted to talk about the problems of the EU?
Yeah, I live in the UK half a year. Mm. And so even though, you know, that's a non-Eurozone country, we're all in the middle of everything. And I'm active in left politics. And I've worked with members of Syriza in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
You are absolutely right. The main problem there is everybody is trying to follow the same neoliberal economic policies that the WTO has for the world. And it's not working because each country is willing to give up much less of its social welfare spending to meet budgetary guidelines. And that's what has produced this fiasco.
Well, and there's actually a good reason for that beyond just, hey, we don't want to be a welfare state. And that is that what the welfare state does is it fills in the potholes created by the business cycle.
I'm not arguing that, Tom.
Pardon?
I understand that.
Yeah,
that's what I'm supporting. And
no,
I'm
not disagreeing with you, Timothy. I was just trying to add to what you were saying. Pardon my interrupting.
But that has been the big problem is that you've had, the UK being completely free market. You've had the social democratic markets of Germany and France and the Scandinavian countries. And then you've had the underdeveloped economies in the South.
Right.
And the discrepancies there, nobody can stay within the 3% budget deficit guidelines and maintain the same complete open free trade policies, not just between EU or Eurozone countries, but with the world.
Yeah.
So that's the collapse. And until we all get away, the United States, Europe, until we all get away from the WTO, the IMF, the World Bank, and these neoliberal economic policies, Reaganomics, Thatcherism, F.A. Hayek, von Mises, Friedman, everything based on them.
Both Friedmans.
That's the mess, and we've got to get away from that, or you are right, everything is going to collapse.
Yeah, and there will be war.
Yes,
there will be war.
I see that in Europe now, and you are right. Fortunately, the left, like with Syriza in Greece, a strong left, is much larger than the neo-fascists.
Than the Golden Dawn.
But they are there.
But the Golden Dawn is
there.
And
they are not to be underestimated.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Timothy, very, very well said. Thank you for the call, and thanks for the validation. Good to know I'm not totally crazy. Jay in Oswego, Illinois. Hey, Jay, what's up?
We're all a little crazy because of this. Let me use the acronym NWO, New World Order. We talk about what could be done, what we should do. But as they usher in this new era of serfdom, I mean, we really have to...
They already have. They started it 30 years ago. It's just now becoming obvious.
Well, that's a good point. It is. Well, I mean, maybe even longer than that. I mean, I think it's probably since the beginning of, you know, when the Fed was created and all the ties to the Fed and the UN.
In some ways, but you know, the Fed... the Fed went along just fine with the New Deal and, you know, Roosevelt's socialism and you know, even things like Glass-Steagall. I mean, you know, we had never gone more than 15 years from the George Washington administration until the time of Franklin Roosevelt. We had never gone more than 15 years without a major banking panic in the United States. Never. And from 1935, when Glass-Steagall was passed, until, 2006, we didn't have one single major banking panic. Why? Because of Glass-Steagall. Or in large part, you know, that and other banking regulations. Fed was fine with all those things. But this the Reaganomics, this deregulation, this cutting taxes on rich people, this Reaganomics is what is destroying us. Thatcheronomics is what's destroying Europe. And it all goes back to Milton and Tom Friedman.
I just think, look at the logic here. I mean, when we look at this sequester, let's get some reporting on this for what it really is. It's really another dash at the middle class. I mean, the point I wanted to make is...
It's austerity.
I looked at the Forbes 100 list, and I did some basic math, and it occurred to me that the top 100 and their holdings combined with a one-time levy or tax of 28% of those holdings would eliminate our debt. So I guess my question is, you guys could meet with 100 guys and swear this thing away, or you can keep playing games and keep tearing apart the middle class, right? Isn't it come down to that?
Yeah.
So isn't this all deception fostered on the people? And then how far do we go with this ideology? I guess this is an ideology of trying to fix it.
Yeah.
I guess
Jay, your question is answered, I think, in part by Ralph Nader in his book, Only the Rich Can Save Us Now. Only the super rich can save us now. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but his suggestion is that, you know, we've got to get together the Forbes 100 and tell them, you guys want to still have a country? You got to do something. I disagree with Ralph. I don't think they're going to listen, but, you know.
Now it's globalist, though, right? Now it's
sure.
Global. I mean, isn't this really the deception that let's all hold hands, the world is united, you know, and then they do it digitally first with Facebook, and now everyone feels good about it, even though you're slowly being squeezed and destroyed, you're making less money than ever, but by God, you know what, I can go on and friend someone in another place.
Yeah.
Gee, don't I feel happy?
Yeah.
You know, and as we all go along with this, like lemmings, I mean, hey, as long as we have social media, Tom, who cares, right?
Well, yeah.
That's really
Twitter took down Mubarak, after all. Isn't it wonderful? No, Jay, excellent point. Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Harmon program, we'll have the latest in the congressional battle of the budgets. Plus, will our economy feel the shockwaves from Cyprus? I think so. And my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science. Plus, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Harmon program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You got to get out there, get active, tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.